Am I so frightening, fire filth? It's as I thought. You were lucky against Gravnach. His heart failed while fighting, and it had nothing to do with you.
I don't want to kill you, I said, shaking off my confusion, turning my back on the king's balcony.
Fortunately, I have no such qualms.
His blade flashed toward me. I threw mine up to block, but miscalculated the arc of his, which tore into my upper arm. I hissed in pain and stumbled back. The captain's teeth flashed in a satisfied smile.
You're worthless with a sword. You hold it like you're carving a roast.
Before I could take a breath, he feinted right and slashed left, the sword cutting into leather straps and the skin at my side. I clapped a hand over the warm blood that wet my skin.
You make it so easy, Fireblood, the captain said.
With a lightning slash, he cut a lock of my hair. The strands scattered in the breeze like poplar fluff. The crowd laughed and cheered at the captain's display of precision. With a cry of frustration, I threw my blade to the ground and sent a spiral of fire at his leggings. He screamed and swore as he battered at the fabric. He aimed a stab at my heart. I leaped free. I kept him at a distance with a series of sizzling arrows that landed at his feet. The crowd picked up its chant. Die, Fireblood, die! The captain circled me, murder in his eyes. It was the same look, lazy but with a hint of satisfaction, that he'd worn just before he killed my mother. A blur came from behind him. I had all but forgotten about Clay until I saw his shackled wrist come down on the back of the captain's head, sending him to his knees.
"That's for my village, you scum," Clay said, spitting at the captain.
"Clay, no!" I moved to push him away, but the captain reacted with blinding speed. Still on his knees, he twisted his sword behind him, running it through Clay's belly before I could even draw a breath. Clay's wide eyes met mine as he fell to the ground. I screamed, feeling the pain in my gut as if it were my own. Darkness stirred in my heart, rearing up and filling my limbs. My mind sharpened. My attacks became faster and smoother. I used Tail of the Dragon, this time aimed at the captain's chest. It cracked him like a whip and heated his metal breastplate. I followed that with another hit and another. A series of fire arrows, a hot, twisting wind that picked up dust from the arena floor and whipped it into his eyes. I used every attack I knew and improvised some more, one after the other and then over again. He fell back, reeling. I put out a hand and sent boiling heat at his sword. He cried out and dropped the weapon. Now was my chance. I could finish him off and be done. My mother's killer would be dead and I would finally be free of him. Out of the corner of my eye, I caught sight of two people leaning over the edge of the railing. The captain's wife, her face pinched and strained, her hair covered in a kerchief, and their wide-eyed daughter, her long braid falling over her shoulder. I paused. His daughter would be just like me, plunged into grief, her only thoughts of vengeance. She would hate all Firebloods forever. There was no end to this cycle of revenge. "Pretend to die," I said, turning back to the captain. "I'll throw a blast at you. Let it knock you down and stay down. They won't find out you're alive until it's too late. I won't kill you." While I'd hesitated, he had recovered, picking up his sword and holding it with grim purpose.
"You must be mad, fire filth. I will kill you."
"You have no gift of frost. You must know you have no chance. Look!" I gestured to the stands, still circling, keeping my distance. "Your daughter is here. I don't want to kill you in front of her." I swallowed and whispered words I never thought I would say. That won't bring my mother back.
A calculating light entered his eyes. I don't need frost. Frost didn't help your precious monks when we raided their abbey and put swords in their bellies.
My skin went cold. The world tipped beneath my feet. I don't believe you.
Because you don't want to. And here's something else you won't like, fire filth. I heard you talking with the village brat. He was telling the truth. He didn't send for us. You did. Now I know you're a liar. We had a temporary camp on Mount Vex, just northwest of your dung heap of a village. You liked to go into the woods and build a fire, didn't you? To practice your little tricks.
You couldn't have seen.
Two of my people saw you in the woods putting your hands in the fire, but you weren't burned.
He lunged toward me and I leaped backwards, scrambling to regain my balance. The villagers didn't even know I was a fireblood, you bastard.
The boy did. He was paid handsomely for his confession. Not that it does much good to him now.
If what he said was true, it was worse than I'd ever thought. It wasn't the simple fact that I was a fireblood that had drawn the soldiers, nor the fact that I'd tried to save Clay's brother. It was my carelessness. My insistence on practicing despite the danger to everyone around me, including my mother, the person I'd loved most. She had paid for my selfishness with her life. Movement brought the moment back into focus. While the captain had distracted me, the fire that blocked the tiger had died down. The captain leaped out of the way as a blur of blue and white stripes sprang from the side. I released a stream of fire, but the target was too fast and my aim was wide. Heavy paws hit my shoulders, knocking me to the ground. The air left my lungs, the tiger's spittle flying into my face. Its head angled toward my neck, the long teeth bright and deadly. My nerves screamed for action. Before I could summon my heat, a sword tip appeared through the animal's neck. The creature made a horrible gagging noise and blood spurted from its mouth. It fell on me and was still. I grunted and heaved, struggling to shift the body off me. Another pair of hands appeared, pushing the carcass to the side. The captain stood over me, blotting out the sun.
"I wanted the satisfaction of killing you myself," he said, raising his sword.
Time slowed. Darkness swirled in my chest, and the world changed, becoming a painting in black and white. I saw my mother. The captain's sword above her head, the look on his face as he brought the weapon down. My own screams in my ears as she crumpled to the snowy ground. That look was on his face now. That killing look. I was going to die. I would become a tale to jest about over a tankard of ale, surrounded by warmth and family, which I would never have because he'd taken mine away. Once again, all doubt, all sense of right and wrong faded. There was only the target, his darkly beating heart, and my fire. There was no fear, no anger, no shame, no regret, just power surging through me, filling me. It felt as if my breath sucked the very air from the heavens and my rage burned the sun to ash. I was everything and nothing, and no one could stop me. I was darkness wreathed in flesh. I raised my hand. Fire licked out with barely a second's thought. The captain shuddered and jolted, each spastic movement lasting eons. Finally, his sword fell to the ground, the dust flying up around it in white grains that caught the sun. As he slowly fell to the earth, I was filled with ecstasy. There had never been such bliss. I stood and looked at the crowd, the people's forms and faces moving slowly, black and white and grey, chanting something. Each one of their hearts was a black stain in their chests. I turned and found the king on his balcony. He was grey, his heart black. But as I watched, he darkened, his shoulders growing pointed, his head growing horns. A shadow beast stood in his place, and it called to me. I wanted to be a part of it. It was me, and I was it. I took a step closer. Something was thrown from the stands and hit the back of my head, splattering seeds. I fell to my knees, and the world snapped into focus. The colour came back in a painful rush. My body ached and stung. I cried out at the terrible loss. The power was gone. I keened my agony, the separation unbearable. The announcer's voice came from the edge of the arena.
The Fireblood wins again! 3 cheers for the Fireling!
There were no cheers for me, but the crowd's shouts receded, like a wave pulling back into the sea. Dimly, I sensed their confusion and shock that a Fireblood had won again. The captain lay next to me, his eyes still wide with shock, a trickle of blood coming from his mouth. I had done this. Where he had breathed and fought only moments ago, he was now empty and still. I scanned the crowd. The captain's wife was bent over, shaking with grief. His daughter, on the other hand, was dry-eyed. There was too much hate brimming there to leave room for tears. I had turned her into me. "He killed my mother," I whispered, as if that would make any difference. Her father was gone, along with the money he earned for bread. Obsession would grow and consume her, as it had me.
"Fireling," said the king's voice from his balcony behind me.
I turned just in time to see his hand draw back and whip forward, sending arrows of ice toward me. I threw myself out of the way, but a large chunk of sharpened ice, big as a sword, came sailing through the air and embedded itself into the ground just inches from my head. The crowd cheered. His face broke into a wide grin.
Such a fearsome champion. And yet, as everyone can see, her powers are no match for mine. The most accomplished and powerful Fireblood cowers before me. Behold the power of the Throne of Fours.
He spread both arms wide, and ribbons of frost spooled from his hands, coating the walls of the arena in a fresh layer of ice as it hardened. The crowd gasped and applauded. The king swept his arms forward, and the entire floor of the arena was turned to ice. Then a deadly rain fell from his hands, sharp pieces of ice that winged towards me, forcing me to crouch and cover my face and head. A few pieces pierced the fabric of my tunic, scraping my flesh. The darkness swirled up in me, turning the world to black and white again. I turned to see the king, but there was no beating heart as a target, only a black figure in his place. In a few seconds, the rain ended, but the crowd kept cheering. I stumbled toward the alcove where Bracca waited. When our eyes met, she startled and drew back.
"Your eyes!"
"What?" I prompted. She tilted her head and blinked.
"I thought..."
"Nothing." Numb and shaking, I limped back into the alcove.
"You did it again, Fireling," said Bracca.
though how you did, I cannot figure. I couldn't either, and I was more frightened than I'd ever been. Chapter 24. The guards escorted me back to my room. I leaned against the closed door. A bitter taste coated my tongue. I held my breath for as long as I could, knowing that when I breathed, time would start again, and I would feel the sharp talons of grief scratching my heart into ribbons. I slid to the floor, legs drawn up against the uneven rise and fall of my chest. Losing Clay had been like losing my home all over again, like watching my village burn. But far worse was hearing the captain's revelations about the abbey. Ransacked, violated, the monks dead. Why hadn't they protected themselves? Brother Thistle with his foolish, lofty ideals and his hopeful prophecies. Did he think he would be immune to the king's wrath? He had rescued me from the prison and died for it. And where was Arcas? He had claimed he wanted to keep me safe. Had he forgotten about me? I was losing myself, bit by bit. The bliss I'd felt after killing the captain. The change Bracca had seen in my eyes. Revenge suddenly seemed so hollow. Firewood that had once burned bright, but now lay in ashes. The darkness had been stronger this time, sharper. If I kept fighting in the arena, if I kept killing, would I be lost forever? If everyone I cared about was gone, would I care? Stumbling upright, I ripped off my mask, hurled it away, and threw myself down on the bed, still wearing my armor. I heard the door open and shut. "Not now, Dorina," I said. "It's me." I turned my head with effort. "I don't want to see you either." Morella swanned into the room, a long-limbed vision in a turquoise gown that rustled as she came forward. I could smell the combination of rosewater and soap on her skin, a sharp contrast to my reek of sweat and blood. I realized that my arm stung, my ankle throbbed, and I had a hand over the gash at my side, though I hadn't been conscious of the wounds until now. She lifted her skirts and stepped carefully around the trail of blood I'd left on the floor. I curled up with my back turned to her. "You keep winning," she said, finally, a hint of pride in her voice. "I told him you weren't weak." "Winning is what's killing me. Every time I win, I lose part of myself. I can't do this anymore." "I understand you're grieving and feeling lost, but you will heal, both in body and mind." "You can't begin to understand. I'm sure you're right. But you're too important to give up," she said, squeezing my shoulder before letting her hand fall away. "What's in your heart, Ruby? Is it only fire? Or is there something else?" My mouth opened and shut several times before I managed to speak. "What do you mean?" "I think you know. In the arena, something helped you defeat your opponents. And that is the key to what we both want. Do you understand what I'm saying?"
"No."
"You know more than you're admitting. But perhaps this is a bad time." She bent and straightened with the discarded mask dangling from her fingertips. "You don't need to wear your mask with me, Ruby." The words were teasing, but her eyes were serious. "I see right through it." She laid the mask on the bed and left with a graceful swish of her perfumed skirts. Sometime later, a hissing sound woke me. My whole body felt stiff. I realized I had fallen asleep, still wearing my armor. I rubbed my eyes and turned my head on the pillow. Shadows were easing under the door of my room in wispy, smoke-like tendrils, dancing in a kaleidoscope pattern before joining and pouring together, as if black water filled a transparent vessel. It formed from the legs up, finally standing before me, a dark, solid-looking creature, and yet I felt that if I tried to touch it, I would fall into an endless void. It was larger than a man, with pointed shoulders and an ever-changing pattern of horns on its head, sometimes mimicking the look of a crown. I lay on the bed, frozen in fear. It moved forward, each step swishing with a strange resonance, like the lowest note played on a flute. When it reached the bed, it stopped and bent over me. "True vessel," it said in the voice of a thousand chimes. "You and I will join when your heart is bled of colour, when perfect darkness inhabits your soul. You will feel freedom as you've never felt it." It reached for me, and I tried to scream, only to jerk upright at the sound of a knock on my door. I clutched the bedding, my eyes wide. The room was empty. The door opened, and Irina entered with small steps, her soft brown shoes making no sound. "Can I help Milady remove her armor?" She sucked in a breath when she saw the dried blood, muttering about the lax habits of the court healer who should have arrived by now. She quickly but carefully unfastened the breastplate. I sat stiffly, unable to shake the image of the creature reaching out to touch me. Had it been real, or just a dream? "Is something wrong, Milady?" Dorina asked. Realizing I must have a look of horror on my face, I smoothed my expression and assured her I was just tired. Already, her gentle presence was chasing some of the shadows from my mind. The grim-faced court healer eventually came, examining the wound at my side with consternation. "This cut is fairly deep," she said in a tone that implied I'd injured myself on purpose. "You need stitches." The drink she gave me to ease the pain tasted vile and wasn't nearly as effective as Brother Gamut's tea, but it did take the edge off. When she was done stitching and wrapping the wounds, she glared at my ankle. "At least a week of rest, and ice for your ankle." "No shortage of that around here," I muttered. I didn't expect to be allowed to rest as the healer had prescribed, but the days passed full of boredom and mounting frustration. I wanted to explore the castle, learn more about the throne, and strategize what to do next. Instead, I was on my back in bed, trying not to split my stitches. The healer came every day to change my bandages, and Dorina brought my meals, lingering to keep me company if she had time. Sometimes she brought clothes that needed mending, and worked on them while she related the news of the day. Gossip travelled fast in the castle, spreading like disease among courtiers and servants alike. Apparently, the king had been visited by dignitaries from Safra, who had all but begged him to consider a peace treaty. Within hours, the ambassadors were seen riding from the castle, their shoulders stooped in defeat. Some witnesses said that only one dignitary made it to the foot of the mountain, that the king had disposed of the others as punishment for their temerity, leaving one alive to take the Frost King's message to King Remus in the east. Brother Thistle had told me during one of our lessons that the Saffron army was sizable and well-trained, or had been before the war started. But by all accounts, the king seemed unconcerned that they were a threat. His army, led by Frostblood generals, had taken control of the kingdom's most valuable assets, mines and mineral deposits in the northwest, and only had to hold that ground. What did seem to bother the king were reports of rebellion. Word around the castle was that he'd sent out more spies, and had started spending more time in the war room with his advisers. But Dorina said the rumours were based in hope, not fact. Because, she pointed out, who would dare rebel against the Frost King? Unfortunately, she couldn't tell me any more about the throne than what I already knew. When I found out she could read, I tried to persuade her to search the royal library for books about the throne, but she shivered at the very suggestion. I contented myself with reading the heavy volumes brought by a servant, with compliments from the king, histories of the military glory of Frost Kings for the past 1,000 years. If nothing else, they helped me fall asleep. Mirella didn't visit. I wondered if she still had plans for me, or whether she'd lost interest. Perhaps deciding my injuries meant that I wasn't as strong as she'd hoped. Finally, after the prescribed week, the healer was satisfied with my progress and declared me fit for regular activity. Within minutes of her departure, a guard clumped into the room. "Do never knock," I asked stiffly, putting down one of the thick history books. He gave me a sour look. "You are to join the king for dinner." I was taken again to bathe and dress, with help from Dorina. This time, my dress was robin's egg blue, with white ribbons that crisscrossed under my breasts and at my waist. Elaborate filigree earrings with blue stones hung from my ears. My hair curled in ringlets at the end, left loose down my back. Dorina spread something waxy on my lips to make them shine. "You look lovely," Dorina said. "The king is in danger tonight." "What do you mean?" I asked sharply. "Falling in love with you when you look like that." I shuddered. "Bite your tongue." Her head tilted slightly. "It wouldn't be the first time a Frostblood king fell in love with a Fireblood, you know." Her words reminded me of a conversation with Arcus, the night we'd sat side by side under a crescent moon, his profile barely visible in the fading light, his cloak billowing in the wind, his eye glinting in the starlight whenever he looked at me. It had been the first time he'd trusted me enough to tell me about his past. He'd also told me about the Frost King, who had loved a Fireblood lady. The memory brought a little flutter in my stomach. "I've heard the story of the Fireblood who became queen. Did the people accept her?" "Well..." Her eyes flicked to mine, then away. "Actually, it ended tragically. The queen was murdered. It's said that a noblewoman who loved the king was jealous and plotted the queen's death. She died on their first anniversary." A shiver traced my spine. "What a terrible story." She nodded thoughtfully, a crease between her brows. "Affairs between fire and frost rarely end well." I stood while she finished with my hair, but couldn't help dwelling on the fate of the poor Fireblood Queen. A few minutes later, the guards deposited me in the dining room. Candlelight bounced off the icy chandelier and fluttered against the frost-tricked walls. The smell of roasted meat and spices filled the air. This time, there were no richly gowned women, no courtiers, only the king at the head of the table, his hair gilded by candlelight. My gaze went to the chair where the captain had sat the last time I'd been in this room. I'd sat just 2 seats over, wishing he were dead. Now he was, and he'd died by my hand. The king was dressed in black, the colour so stark against his pale skin and hair that I was reminded of the moments in the arena when the world had turned black and white. But the candles were still gold, the walls tinged with blue. I took a deep breath and blotted out the memory. Once again, the king motioned to the chair next to him. I walked toward him slowly, heart pounding in my ears, and sat on the white fur. He looked handsome and austere. My hands trembled in my lap. The last time I had sat here, he had lied to me about the monks. I had an impulse to leap forward and take him by the throat, or to burn him where he sat. But even away from the throne he radiated power, and he demonstrated that in the arena. My fire had no chance against him. He regarded me steadily, his lips showing slight amusement, but his eyes narrowed. I was struck by the strangeness of his eyes, mostly black, with just a rim of deep blue around the edges.
"You look even lovelier tonight, Ruby."
I stiffened at his familiar use of my name. He eased back in his chair.
"I fulfilled my end of our bargain,"
he said evenly. "I gave you the captain. Aren't you grateful?" I didn't want to kill him. Not like that.
"Not like that,"
he imitated with a dismissive wave of his hand, his eyes sweeping my straight-backed figure.
"You're very finicky, Fireling. You wanted to kill him, and now you have. That's all that matters."
"His wife was watching," I said through numb lips. "His young daughter. And he told me the monks are dead. By your orders." His brows creased, his expression turning to intense speculation before it smoothed into his usual blank carelessness.
"Ah, well, perhaps I've forgotten."
I wasn't surprised that he had lost track of all the deaths. How could anyone remember so many? But the casual way he had said the words stunned me. Rasmus made a motion with his hand, and a steward came forward, piling his plate with food. When the servant went to do the same for me, I put my hand over my plate and glared until he stepped away. The king regarded me for long moments with a heavy-lidded gaze, both of us silent and still. He stood and grabbed my wrist in a biting grip. His cold skin burned into me more than fire ever could. "You're hurting me," I said, trying to twist away.
"Your touch hurts me too,"
he replied, his voice as rough as his hand as he pulled me closer. "But it's a pain I enjoy." Arcus had once told me that my touch unsettled him, made him uncomfortable because it penetrated his defences and made him feel things he didn't want to feel. But this was different. The king's touch hurt me and mine hurt him. If it gave him pleasure, it was a twisted one. He drew me along to the wall opposite the head of the table, then pressed a barely visible recess on the stone wall that must have been a kind of mechanism. A hidden door swung open. We entered a narrow tunnel lit with torches. The ceiling was so low he had to bend his head.
"This tunnel is for me alone," he said,
his hold on my wrist easing as we walked, his voice muffled in the tight space.
"You enjoy an incredible privilege by seeing it. I do so only as an act of great trust."
My senses quickened. I hadn't done anything to earn his trust, and yet, if it was there, I had to use it to my advantage. After a minute, we came to another door. The king pushed it open to reveal the throne room, draped in torchlight and shadows, the sky black against a moonless night. The throne was a large, menacing presence. Ice flowed down it and into the hallway and, I knew, all through the castle, even out into the arena. When I'd first seen it, I'd thought it looked like veins connected to a heart. Now, as shadows darted about in the walls, I realized the Minax lived in the throne, but moved about in the ice connected to it. I stifled a gasp as the familiar, invisible force stole my fire. "What are we doing here?" I asked, my voice subdued by the pressing shadows. "I thought we were to dine."
"You refuse to eat. I'm tired of games. This is where you really want to be. I give this to you as a gift."
He pulled me forward until we stood within an arm's reach of the throne. Its dark power beat against me in waves. I wanted to cringe away, to run, but at the same time, I felt an insistent pull, moth to flame. "Do you feel that?" he asked, pressing my hand to the throne. "Pure power." The throne was created by Fors himself as a gift to his Frostblood people. "Did you know that?" "Yes," I whispered, cold spreading up my arm. "But Fors is your god, not mine. It burns me." A further gift was bestowed by his brother, Eurus. Some call it a curse from a jealous god who sought to destroy his brother's creation. But it's really a gift of power that only the chosen can feel. To unlock it completely, you must have the right person. Someone who was created to bear a power so great. "The Child of Darkness," I murmured, pulling against his grasp. "Yes. When I took the throne, it told me to find the child. Together, she and I will bring darkness to the land, and with her, I'll be complete." His eyes burned with intensity, an excitement I'd never seen before. I shook my head, my mind writhing with denial as his meaning sank in. I'm not the Child of Darkness. His icy fingers touched my chin, tilting my face so my eyes met his in the flickering light. "The prophecy says the Child of Darkness will have a powerful gift. I've tested all the strongest Frostbloods and Firebloods in my arena. You are the first to show a connection with the throne. Stop resisting, Ruby, and you'll never know pain again." I shook my head, "But others will. People are suffering and you don't see it. The throne has taken away your mercy. You've become a monster."
"Not a monster," he said,
stroking the curve of my cheek with his thumb. "Together, you and I will be like gods." "I don't want to be a god." I twitched my chin from his fingers. "I want to be a healer like my mother." It was a truth I hadn't known until the words were spoken. I wished I had been given a healer's touch, a healer's gentle patience, instead of the rage of emotions that went with the power that killed and maimed. "You deny it, but killing gives you pleasure. It allows the darkness to seep in further, merging with you more with each death." He pulled me to his chest and found my lips with his. Cold and hot merged with darkness to create a new flame. His lips were hard, but they warmed under mine and filled with a twisting excitement. His hand came to my face and tangled in my hair, the sharp stone of his ring cutting into my cheek. His lips found the hollow under my chin, moving down my throat in a cool caress. A rush of sensation blurred my thoughts. Pleasure mixed with distaste in equal measure. My hands found his shoulders to push him away, but held on instead. The king lifted his head and smiled. "My bloodthirsty fireling," he whispered, smoothing the pads of his fingers across my lips. "Just one more fight, I think, and you'll be ready. Once you let the Minax merge with you, its power will increase tenfold, and together we'll share it." "I won't merge with it." "You've already been doing so in my arena. Surely you've sensed it helping you. It lends you power to kill, and your killing makes it stronger. With it comes perfect bliss." His words reminded me of the dream, the dark thing telling me that we would merge when my heart was black. "But the Minax is already part of you," I said. He shook his head slightly. "It advises me, lends me the power of the throne, eases my worry. Yes, by virtue of my crown I share some of its power, but I can't merge with it completely. Not the way you can." Once you and the Minaks are one, we'll create a perfect rule over a perfect kingdom. No rebellion could withstand our combined power. No country will be able to defy my rule, and with it inside you, we won't be restricted to the castle. We can go anywhere, and its power will come with us. Now I understood why the king had forced me into the arena. He could manipulate me so easily, forcing me to kill or be killed, every time opening cracks in my soul to let in more darkness. What would I become if I let him shape me into the creature he seemed so intent, even excited, to create? Like Eurus creating his shadows, there was no thought of right or wrong, only pleasure in the act of creation, of having control over another being. I tried to pull away, but it felt as though I were caught in amber. His hand came up and caressed my throat. Revolted pleasure surged through me. A great shadow rose from the throne, its shoulders pointed and two great horns growing from its head. The Minaks looked more solid than it had in the arena, the same shape, only gaining bulk and dimension, as if it were becoming more corporeal as I watched. A tendril morphed into a black hand that reached out and stroked the tip of my finger, sending tingling darkness up my arm and over my chest. Grief was swept away and replaced with heady power. It was draining all the painful feelings from me, replacing them with a blank, empty kind of joy. I wanted to throw myself into that embrace. I wanted to forget everything and welcome oblivion. It took a few seconds to realize that my heat had come back to me. The Minaks had given me my fire. The chiming voice of my dream whispered in my mind, "Let us be one. Together we will be free." I suddenly had an overpowering urge to use my heat on the throne, to melt every last bit of ice until only a puddle remained in its place, to set the Minaks free. Before I could react, Rasmus's lips came back to mine, harder, more insistent. My mind scrabbled to take hold of something stable, something that would ground me in this storm of confusion. A jolt of memory tore through me, another set of lips, cold but ardent, moving against mine. For a second, it was Arcus kissing me. I felt his cheeks under my palms, the silky strands of his hair at my fingertips. I saw his lips descending to mine. Other images came thick and fast. His profile in the dark, the waver in his voice when he told me he didn't want to let me go, his conviction that I was strong. As hope and longing swelled inside me, the dark thing quivered and retreated. It was poised, though, ready to come back to me. I took advantage of its retreat, shoving the king with all my strength and running to the main doors, pounding on them with both fists. I heard a laugh. I didn't know whether it was the king or the shadow hovering over the throne. At the king's command, the guards opened the doors, took my arms, and led me back to my room. I sat on my bed, my arms wrapped around myself. The king had seen the darkness inside me, and I couldn't deny it was there. I had welcomed it, and him, not just letting him kiss me, but returning his kisses. I closed my eyes against a surge of shame. Much as I wanted to deny it, I had enjoyed it. Almost as much as I'd enjoyed killing in his arena. And now the Minaks was speaking to me, telling me we would merge, that we would be one. I could no longer dismiss my earlier vision as a dream. The thing was becoming more powerful, more solid, the longer I stayed here. The more I killed. Hands over my face, I rocked back and forth. What had I become? Even now, I longed for that darkness, for its sinuous caress, like Brother Gamut's tea that eased all pain, only 1,000 times stronger. I ached for the obliteration of worry and pain, even as the implications of what I would become repulsed me. I hated the king, hated him to the depths of my spirit. And yet he'd woken something in me, a thirst for mindless power I couldn't control. I hopped off the bed and paced back and forth from stone wall to wooden door. When Brother Thistle had explained the plan to me, the evening sun streaming through the windows of the chapter house, he had seemed so confident. I would come to the castle and destroy the throne. Now that I was in the castle, nothing was simple. I couldn't kill the king because the throne protected him. I couldn't destroy the throne because I had no power in its presence, except when I was in contact with the king. Part of me just wanted to surrender, to let my next opponent strike me down. I could finally join my mother in the afterworld in the sky. If I truly were the child of darkness, it would be better for the world if I was dead, rather than becoming some unstoppable power at the right hand of the king. The thought hovered there, dark and heavy and undeniable. Unfortunately, I didn't think the darkness would let me die. In the past 2 fights, it had snaked up and taken me over when I was under threat. Every time it was stronger. Even if I fought against that shadow power, I didn't know if I could win. Let the darkness take me then. The king has won. With the suddenness of a shutter being thrown open to let in the light of day, an image came to my mind of my grandmother telling stories in front of the fire. I saw her lips moving, felt her hand on my hair. When the story was done, she would often give me a piece of wisdom to take from it. There is always light in the darkness. It may only be a pinpoint, but it is there. Follow it, and you will find your way free. Letting myself be taken by the dark was forfeiting my choice. Surely I was stronger than that. I could fight the Minax and its plans for me. I wouldn't kill again, no matter how strong the urge. I would lose in the arena, but I would win the battle against the king. With my death, his hopes of finding a vessel for the Minax would be crushed, and perhaps another Fireblood, someone more powerful, more cunning and strong, would come along and destroy the throne. It just wouldn't be me. "I will find the light, Grandmother," I whispered. Chapter 25
"Ruby!" Bracca called.
I blinked, and the familiar sounds and sights of the arena came into focus. I was half sick, half numb at the prospect of what I had to do.
"What is it?"
"Your opponent," she said, her grey eyes serious. "He calls himself Cain. He's rumoured to be a seasoned warrior come back from the wars. Like Gravnach, he uses no weapon but frost. Keep your distance, and look for points he leaves unguarded, then focus on his weak spots."
My brows rose, her earnest words pulling me out of the fog of resignation.
"Bracca, are you actually giving me pointers?
Be careful, or the others will think you like me." She smiled, displaying her missing tooth.
"I do like your filing. You're brave and strong, and you have powers that, well, frankly, confound me. I believe you can win any fight. You'll even win the crowd eventually."
My lips twisted. Unlikely. I see them preparing to launch their vegetables as we speak. She chuckled.
"There's something about you," she said thoughtfully, "that grows on a person. Like icicles."
I smiled up at her. I'm nothing whatsoever like icicles. She paused in thought.
Like fungus, then?
I chuckled. Much better. She clapped me on the back, the jovial pat reverberating through me.
No fear, Filing. You haven't lost yet.
The current match was longer than usual, with one of the few female Frostbird challengers I'd seen. The two opponents were similar in size, but the woman had a clear advantage because of her stronger frost, though her male opponent often made gains with brute strength. Every match still made me sick to watch. That sickness reassured me. It meant I wasn't numb to the waste of life. At least, not yet. I caught a familiar floral scent and turned to see Morella standing behind me, goddess-like in a silver dress with silk flowers sewn onto a full skirt. Some of the same silk flowers were woven into her elaborately coiled hair. Icy gems set in silver winked from her earlobes and fingers, catching shafts of light from the arena. "I came to wish you luck," she said with a dazzling smile. "I appreciate the thought," I replied, adjusting my mask. "But I don't need luck. I don't want it." Her lips quirked. "You're right. Luck is for fools. You're quite capable of destroying this challenger the way you've obliterated all the others." The words sent a chill across the back of my neck. "I'm not going to destroy anyone. I can't do this anymore." Her brow puckered. "You have no choice, Ruby. It's not your fault you're forced to do this. It's kill or be killed." "Exactly. And every time I kill, something takes hold of me. A darkness I can't control." I paused. "I've decided not to kill again. Perhaps your guilt..." "It's not guilt. I believe it's the Minax from the throne." I waited to see her reaction, but her face remained perfectly blank. "I'm sure it sounds like I've gone mad, but..." "I know about the throne," she said simply. "I told you. Don't wear your mask with me. I was inviting you to confide in me and allow me to help you." "How can you possibly help me?" "I've been preparing for this day for half my life, reading the dustiest tomes in my father's library, researching the throne, sneaking out at night to consult with scholars." She smiled at my consternation. "My father may be a fusty old sermonizer, but his saving grace is his collection of books. I know the old stories, and I've seen for myself that there's more truth to them than most people believe." A cheer went up from the crowd, but I didn't bother to turn and look at what caused it. I was too ensnared by Morella's revelations. "King Akur went through a marked change during his reign," she said. "His wife and children saw it. My father and the closest court members saw it. And so did the royal scholar, who believed the throne was the real cause of our war on Five Bloods. He believed the curse in the throne woke and was growing in influence. He told the king that as long as we treated Sud's people unfairly, the repercussions in fighting would be endless. And then King Akur's wife was murdered, proving Brother Thistle's theories right. The only reason he wasn't executed for his treasonous opinions was that he shares the same blood as the largest landowner in the eastern provinces. If Thistle's cousin, Lord Trillin, had pulled his support for the king, it would have meant disaster for the border wars. So Thistle was banished to a crumbling old abbey on Mount Tuna, and he and his predictions were forgotten." "Why didn't you tell me sooner?" I asked, half accusingly. "I would have told you everything." "I didn't know if I could trust you. You have a bond with Raz. He looks at you in a way I've never seen him look at anyone." There was a brief flash of emotion in her eyes. "There are a great many reasons you could choose to reveal me, and I didn't want to take the chance. But now you're talking of dying in the arena today, and that risk is much greater. To all of us. I paused. You think I can destroy the throne, then? She took my hands in hers, her fingers cool but not frigid. I know you can, Ruby. Today is the summer solstice, when your powers are greatest. If it's any day, it must be today. Solstice. I remembered Brother Thistle saying that it was just over 3 weeks away, but the days had passed, and I'd lost track. But Morella, I'm afraid I'll be lost, and I won't even want to destroy it. It'll merge with me, and then... what would I become? Her fingers tightened on mine, her voice becoming urgent. Merging with it is the only way to destroy it. Don't you see? If you can do that, you can turn its power on itself. It's not only your fire you need, it's your darkness. That's what makes you special. How do you know? I've watched countless Firebloods fight and die in this arena, and I've never seen any of them do what you can. The Minax has chosen you. Oh, Sood, help me, I whispered, pulling my hands from hers and covering my face. You already know it's true. That's why you decided not to fight today. You're scared of what you'll become, but I promise you're stronger. You can merge with the Minax and still control it. You can do this, Ruby. You're wrong. I won't risk it. I turned away. Let me tell you something that might change your mind. Your opponent today, Cain, he was one of the soldiers who raided the Abbey. I spun back to her. What? She nodded. I inquired about him for you, hoping I could discover his weaknesses, and I found out that he was assigned to Captain Drake when they went to Mount Una. I heard he was merciless. It was carnage, Ruby, and the young man with the scars was killed too. Argus, I breathed. She nodded, her eyes full of sorrow. A fierce frostblood warrior that fought madly to protect the Abbey, despite the impossible odds. He killed a dozen soldiers before archers brought him down with flaming arrows. A haze blurred my vision. The burning arrows wouldn't have been enough to subdue his frost, but he would have been terrified of those flames. It would have knocked him off guard, weakened his focus. I could see it clearly in my mind, the moment when he had been overcome. I didn't realize I had doubled over until I felt Morella pull me into a tight hug. I'm so sorry, Ruby, she whispered into my hair. I wasn't going to tell you, but now you know why Cain mustn't leave that arena alive. He deserves this death. I gasped and shuddered, feeling myself falling into a million pieces, but helpless to stop it. You can do this. Destroy Cain. Destroy the throne. Otherwise, there's no end to the darkness. With a final squeeze, she pushed me from her, watching the fight with a regretful expression. I followed her gaze and saw that both opponents were on the ground, the announcer raising the Frostblood woman's lifeless hand into the air. The crowd cheered, and servants came and pulled the bodies from the ring, leaving a trail of glistening blue blood behind. The Frostblood woman had apparently won, but she had paid with her life. The announcer gave a signal. I stepped into the sunlit arena. There were the usual jeers and curses, the drizzle of rotten food or rocks landing on the edges of the field, but shockingly, a couple of voices could be heard calling, "Filing!" I was numb to it all, as if I floated above myself, a bystander with no stake in the proceedings. I hoped I would never have to feel again. I turned and found the king on his balcony, Morella now seated like a painted doll to his left, her silver dress billowing out over the arms of her ice-carved seat. His robes were deep black with silver piping. I wondered if she had deliberately dressed to match.